The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I'm not really thinking about, like, we have identified this emerging technology or this very advanced technology, we are going to regulate it. It is instead, let's look at sort of the supply chain that enables the development of these technologies. Are there foreign adversaries involved in the supply chain that we should be concerned about?
It's the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Natalie Orpett, Executive Editor of Lawfare, with Brendan Van Grack and Elizabeth Cannon.
So if we've decided to impose, for example, a mitigating measure, and the company chooses not to effectively implement that mitigating measure, we could instead just move to prohibition.
Today, Lawfare contributing editor Brendan Van Grack and I are talking about the Office of Information and Communications Technology and Services with its executive director, Liz Cannon. It's a relatively new office at the Department of Commerce. This is the latest episode in our special series, The Regulators, co-sponsored with Morrison Forrester, in which we talk with senior government officials working at the front lines of U.S. national security policy.
Liz, your office, which is a mouthful, the Office of Information, Communications, Technology, and Services, it rolls off the tongue.
It really does.
As far as I can tell, it's the newest, or at least one of the newest offices in terms of entities regulating sort of in the national security space and certainly with respect to commerce. And you've now been in this role in terms of heading it for a few months. And so we want to talk about, like, what is the office? Why was it created? And how? Like, how, in fact, are you regulating? But I want to start off with your background, because I think it helps sort of set the stage and set the context for the office and why you're so well suited to lead it. And so can talk a little bit about your role with the Justice Department and in the private sector and why that's so important to what you're doing now.
Sure. Thanks. Yeah. So I spent over 11 years in the National Security Division at DOJ prosecuting a variety of national security cases. So espionage, mishandling of classified information, national security cyber cases, as well as export control and sanctions violations. I did that for 6 years, and then I spent my last 5 years there supervising all criminal cases involving export control and sanctions violations across the country. So, you know, in that role, especially as deputy chief for export control and sanctions, I had a lot of interaction with the Department of Commerce and with the Bureau of Industry and Security, which is where this office now sits. I left DOJ in March of 2022 and went to work for Microsoft as senior corporate counsel for global trade. And in that position, I supervised what was called the Risk Intelligence Group, which does all of the trade-related due diligence for the company. I also had what was called our risk portfolio, so looking at the trade compliance program, identifying any potential gaps and how to address those gaps. And then I also tracked all sort of global developments in export control and sanctions policy around the world. So, you know, I think that's for me, when I think about the position I'm currently in, I have sort of a deep understanding of the U.S. government's national security mission from my time at the Justice Department, but I also really fully appreciate the role industry plays in making regulations successful, but also just how challenging it is for industry to comply with new complex regulations, and in particular when those regulations may differ from country to country where they operate. So, you know, as I've come into this role, one of my priorities is to have a lot of engagement with industry and to try to bring as much transparency to this program as possible.
And on the DOJ side, it seems like there are multiple former Department of Justice attorneys that are now in leadership over at Commerce. And I'm wondering how that also plays into it, like why that was important in terms of your background in this particular role.
Yeah. I mean, this role, obviously there is an investigatory piece to it. There's also an ability to work with classified information, though knowing that what we will do, what we are doing will be public, take a public action. So you have to figure out how to balance the sort of pieces that you're learning on the classified side with what you know you need to do in the public. And that sometimes will involve working with the intelligence community to figure out what of these pieces of information that I'm seeing that can be very helpful for our investigation, you know, how can we use those? What can we potentially declassify so that we can use those in our very, you know, public action?
Okay, so let's take a step back to talk about the office generally, because in addition to your being new to it, it's really a brand new office, as Brandon mentioned. So as I understand it, it is charged with implementing four different executive orders and a regulation associated with it, all under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. One thing that struck me as interesting is two of the EOs were from the Trump administration, two from the Biden administration. And just to lay out for folks before I ask you to elaborate a little bit more, the EOs have to do with everything from the supply chain to cyber-enabled activities to protecting private data of U.S. persons to artificial intelligence. So that is quite a lot of things you are responsible for implementing. Can you just talk to us about what the office does and sort of the scope of its mission and its actions on all of those many things?
Yeah. So those four EOs are sort of divided into two buckets, right? The initial executive order was sort of the crux of our authority, which is an ICTS executive order that granted the president and then to the Secretary of Commerce the authority to prohibit or to impose mitigating measures in transactions that involve foreign adversary affiliated ICTS. When I say ICTS, information and communications technology and services, so Brandon mentioned the name of the office, but we will hear that acronym often, ICTS. So the secretary can prohibit or impose mitigating measures when there are transactions that involve foreign adversary affiliated ICTS and when those transactions pose undue risk to the national security of the United States. So that was the initial sort of core executive order for our office. Subsequently, in the Biden administration, an additional EO essentially clarified that connected software applications can be considered a kind of ICTS category that are subject to our authorities and regulations. So it didn't actually give us additional authorities. It was mostly just sort of clarifying that that kind of technology would be included in our ICTS authorities.
Can you give an example of that type of technology just to break this down even one step further?
Well, of course, the one that has mostly been in the news was TikTok. Yeah. Now, for those of you who track this issue, the Trump administration tried to regulate TikTok pursuant to our authority, but because our statutory authority actually comes from IEEPA, there are certain carve-outs in IEEPA that sort of courts decided prevented us from regulating in that space. But that's because TikTok and other sort of social media apps like it offer the exchange of personal communications. And so we could look at potentially other applications that are not just collecting that kind of personal communication exchange, but rather maybe are collecting, they're on your phone, but collecting other kinds of data. So those could potentially be subject to our authorities. The second bucket of authority, there was an executive order in the Trump administration that directed the Commerce Department to create regulations that would require U.S. infrastructure as a service providers or IaaS providers to collect essentially know your customer data points on their foreign users. And the idea behind that was that if IaaS providers were to collect and verify the identity of their foreign users, there would hopefully be less malicious activity in their infrastructure, because those users would have to provide some identity information, which would then be verified by the IaaS provider. That order was then kind of continued and modified in the most recent AI executive order from last fall, which directed the Commerce Department to impose regulations so that not only would those U.S. IaaS providers have to collect those Know Your Customer data points, but their foreign resellers would also have to collect those Know Your Customer data points for the foreign users. And in addition, the Commerce Department was directed to implement regulations that required IaaS providers to report to the Commerce Department when foreign end users, and this also goes to foreign resellers of those IaaS products, they also have to report to the Commerce Department through their U.S. IaaS provider when foreign users are using above a certain threshold of compute power. It sounds very complicated when I sort of say it like this, sort of step by step, but it is essentially trying to get at, are there foreign users that are using such a high threshold of compute power that it would denote that a user is training a very large advanced generative AI model? The threshold of compute is set intentionally very high so that really there would potentially be only a few or a handful of users that might be using that threshold, because it really is trying to get at those frontier models. And so the idea would not be to require these IaaS providers to provide extensive information to the Department of Commerce. It would really be limited to a very select few end users. So those are the sort of the two buckets of authorities. You have our core ICTS authorities, and then you have this sort of Know Your Customer reporting requirement for these IaaS providers.
To just make sure we are level setting, can you just define IaaS and maybe give us some examples of the types of actors that we're talking about that are subject to these regulations?
Sure. So IaaS, infrastructure as a service, is when providers like Microsoft, like AWS, like Google, I mean, they are offering infrastructure services. So they are, end users will come, they will bring their own software, right? But they are really just using the servers, the hardware. That is what these providers are offering their end customers.
I like this game, the do you regulate me? So I'm going to play as well. So social media companies, it sounds like, you use TikTok as an example. So social media companies would be potentially some aspect of their services would be captured by your office?
So social media companies might fall in the ICTS bucket.
Thank you.
Yes, they would not
I combined them together because you're one office, one team, I'm sure. But yes, so the first bucket. So with respect to... it's the first category you talked about for ICTS, sort of the core or original. There are some aspects of social media companies that would be included. So artificial intelligence, sort of is it the development of artificial intelligence that would be regulated by you all? So where do you fall into in terms of that spectrum?
So when I think of our authorities, what I actually think about are the sort of technologies that enable AI development, right? So I'm not really thinking about... like we have identified this emerging technology or this very advanced technology, we are going to regulate it. It is instead, let's look at sort of the supply chain that enables the development of these technologies. Are there foreign adversaries involved in the supply chain that we should be concerned about? Or, you know, are these AI models hosted in like a cloud that we should be concerned about, right? So it's not because the cloud is somehow affiliated with a foreign adversary. Right. So there always has to be the connection to foreign adversaries. And it is a supply chain authority, really.
Yeah. Maybe sort of one other question because or example, which is there was reports, I think it was last month, but I've lost track of time now, of potential sort of communication devices on port cranes. Mm-hmm. That would be an example, therefore, that would fall.
Yeah. In. And I will say, as we think about the kinds of transaction and supply chain issues that we're concerned about, we are trying to focus our attention on critical infrastructure, right? Because our authority is so broad, right? Sort of ICTS, it's a very broad term. What does that actually mean? Like, we have to be able to narrow it somehow. So we do have, and we might get to this later, sort of what are our priority technologies. But we're looking at how those technologies show up in our critical infrastructure and how are they potentially then endangering our critical infrastructure.
You know, the way you describe it, it reminds me of a former colleague of ours from the Justice Department who used to say all criminal cases are cyber cases because everyone uses a computer.
Right. Right.
And so I'm not quite sure what the example is for ICT, yes, but yes.
It seems, yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's broad.
So a question on bucket one, which I think goes to a larger question about how your office fits into the sort of broader national security apparatus. As you were describing, you know, this first bucket involves transactions with foreign adversaries. At a superficial level, that sounds a lot like what CFIUS is charged with dealing with. So can you explain, you know, let's start with that example. How is this different? How is what you guys do different from what CFIUS is charged with doing? And then let's speak a little bit more broadly also about sort of what was the impetus for your office for needing, you know, dedicated people specifically for these executive orders.
Yeah, so let me actually take that last question first, sort of what gave rise to these authorities. You know, I think the original ICTS executive order was issued in 2019. And so you think about kind of what was going on at the time. And just prior to that, in 2017, 2018, you see China implementing a variety of laws that compel ostensibly private companies to provide information to the Chinese government. So you have their cybersecurity law, you have their national intelligence law, all of these laws that require what, you know, present themselves to be private companies, they now have to comply with requests from the Chinese government to turn over vast amounts of data. You also have a recognition by the U.S. government of just the extent of military-civil fusion in China and the fact that there really is no longer a distinction between what is a state-owned enterprise and what is a private company. And you have China becoming a near-peer competitor in technology and very publicly stating its technology goals and wanting to really surpass the United States in a number of areas. And at the same time, that technology is becoming increasingly connected. Right. So all of these things kind of give rise to this idea of there are threats here that did not exist, you know, in the decades before that we do need to address as a national security concern. And so you see the U.S. government taking steps to, you know, ban Huawei and ZTE in government facilities and banning Kaspersky. And then you see the creation of the FASC. So there's a focus on sort of federal supply chain issues. But then there is an additional recognition that these threats also exist, not just in sort of the federal supply chain space, but also in the commercial supply chain space. And so there's a question of, okay, well, what authorities exist that can actually address that threat? And yes, there was CFIUS. CFIUS is a transaction-based review process. So it is transaction by transaction, whereas our authority can look at a class of technology, a class of transactions, so it's much broader. CFIUS is also focused on, you know, investment and acquisition in the United States. It's not just a supply chain procurement review. So our authority, again, is much broader and can address those sort of just procurement supply chain issues. So I think that's really the gap that our program was trying to fill.
So you've talked about the breadth of your office and what it can regulate, including comparing it to CFIUS's scope. So what are your priorities? Are there technologies or particular areas that you're focusing on or focused on at the moment?
Yeah. One of my priorities in coming to the office was to try to narrow the aperture some of our program because it is so broad. And in order to have a program that can be administered, that can function, so that we're not just spinning our wheels every day, I wanted to try to narrow the focus some. So in the original executive order was a requirement that CISA each year draft a sort of criticalities report looking at ICTS vulnerabilities. And so we have that CISA report. We also have the White House's critical and emerging technologies list. So we sort of looked at those lists, looked at the sort of core ICTS that was described in the White House critical and emerging technologies list. And we compared those technologies to what we were seeing in China's stated technology goals. And we actually have some very, very accomplished Mandarin speakers who are very good at doing some analysis of those lists and did some great analysis for us. And so comparing those, we have come up with a list of what we are considering our sort of 2024 technology priorities. So those are satellite access points, mobile networks, autonomous systems, semiconductors and microelectronics, energy generation and storage, advanced and networked sensing and signature management, and then advanced cloud services. Now, even those categories of technology are still fairly broad. And so, again, we're sort of looking at those technologies and then looking at, okay, how do those show up in critical infrastructure? And sort of where can we identify, looking at the supply chain in these technologies for critical infrastructure, where can we identify potential risks?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, Lawfare listeners. Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
Okay, so that's quite a long list. And it seems to me if you're starting with trying to identify specific technologies, that that's sort of the first step of a process that will also then have to involve, of course, who are the actors that are in this supply chain that I have identified as being of concern. So what does that process look like exactly?
Yeah, I mean, so you could look at it a couple ways. One, you could look at our recent connected vehicle ANPRM, where we have identified an autonomous system that shows up in our transportation system. So you have, you know, critical infrastructure as well as one of our priority technologies. And then we are asking the public for information, right? Who are the players in the supply chain, right? What are their relationships to OEMs? What kind of information
what are OEMs?
Original equipment manufacturers? What kind of information gets shared back to the supply chain providers? So that is sort of one way. Another is, one of the things I've done is to invest in some very good analytic tools. So we are looking at global shipping data, which can track technologies being shipped around the world, and then looking at, you know, who is doing the shipping to the United States of these advanced technologies that I've identified, and then looking at those companies, right? What does the ownership structure look like in those companies? And so that is sort of another mechanism to get at some of those answers.
And so, again, it's sort of a broad and impressive list, but let's talk about some of the examples, as you just described, where you actually have been explicit and sort of had targeted. So like connected vehicles, you mentioned. Why connected vehicles out of all that list? You know, what is it about your authorities and that concern that sort of prompted you all to issue that particular advanced notice?
Yeah, I think the connected vehicle space is really interesting. So what we have in that space is, you know, a tremendous amount of connected technology that exists in our vehicles, many of them getting at that sort of autonomous driving issue. We have a marketplace where China, frankly, is about to, you know, is poised to enter the U.S. electric vehicle market. They've already taken about a 25% share of the EU market. And so as we think about these vehicles coming into the United States, we want to better assess the risks associated with them and do it now before they become so pervasive that it is almost then impossible to regulate. Or you'd be looking at a situation like we had with Huawei, where you're doing sort of a rip and replace, and we don't want to find ourselves in that situation. We'd rather act now. And so I think the vehicles, as we described in the ANPRM, present a couple of risks that we've already identified. So one is just the massive amount of a data collection that occurs. And then the other is the risk of remote manipulation in some way. And so I really think it's kind of the confluence of those two risks that then, you know, rises to the level of a potential national security threat that we want to better understand.
So it's to ground it even further, it is not the sort of commercial concern of entering the U.S. market, but it's the data going in and data coming out in terms of who's controlling it and where it's going.
Yeah, thanks for raising that. And this is one thing that I do try to emphasize with our authorities is that we are a national security tool, right? We are not an economic policy or industrial policy tool, right? We are focused exclusively on the national security risks. And whatever way we decide to regulate it, I want it to be the most sort of narrowly scoped option available to address the national security risk.
And so that actually, in terms of the scoping problem, it's interesting then sort of one of the other sort of technologies, infrastructure as a service, which you've talked about now, where there's also been a notice in terms of, and you described it, part of what you're doing with respect to infrastructure as a service is collecting a lot of information. Their requirements in terms of know your customers, their reporting, or at least maybe that's my interpretation of the intent, which is information gathering. Yeah. And I think the question would be, what are you going to do with all of that information?
Yeah. So it's certainly information collecting with regard to the AI piece of it, the high compute threshold users, right? That is actual collection. The other piece of it is a requirement that infrastructure as a service providers collect information about their end customers, collect and verify. And then they won't be submitting that information to the Department of Commerce. I do want to clarify that we are not asking that they send us that information. What they will be submitting to us on some sort of periodic basis will just be what we've described as their customer identification program and sort of what the parameters are, like how they are collecting and how they're verifying. So it will not be, you know, as if an infrastructure as a service provider is some pass-through from an end customer to the Commerce Department. We do not want all of that information. We are not asking for any of that information. But we do want to make sure that, and again, this is a proposed rule, not final, right? So we are, comment period will be ending on the April 29th. So we'll be reviewing those comments and deciding what we actually want the final rule to look like. But so this is just the proposed rule stage. But so we will be reviewing then what their customer identification program looks like, but we are not asking for that end customer information.
Is the expectation though that it would therefore exist for you all to obtain that information, like should the need arise?
So yes, except that I don't actually foresee necessarily the Commerce Department seeking that information. What I actually would envision would be the FBI seeking that information, right? So there is some cybersecurity event. FBI wants to know more about the actors, right? This sort of forces those infrastructures as service providers to at least collect and verify that information that would then be potentially available to the FBI.
So I'm curious, since we are in this phase of really active and clear discussion with industry, since we're in the proposed rulemaking phase, what sorts of comments are you getting thus far? I know the deadline hasn't arrived yet, so undoubtedly there will be more, including from the types of law firms that like to procrastinate until the last minute on behalf of their clients. But what have you heard thus far from industry and others with respect to the proposed rule?
Yeah, so I would just say that because we are now still in the comment period, I am somewhat restricted in what I can say, but you can go on to regulations.gov and see what those comments are. The comments are public.
So you guys have a lot to regulate, and as you are working to narrow your scope, as you were describing, I imagine you also have in mind the other regulators in existence who are already doing work that is adjacent to yours. So I'm wondering how you think about those, what you think are sort of your peer and partner regulators, and how you communicate with them as you are defining your scope.
So our executive order sets out 9 other agencies that we have to consult with before we take an action. So we will and do consult with those agencies through an interagency review process. I'm also very well aware of, for example, DOJ's new data security ANPRM and an executive order. So thankfully, that's an office in the National Security Division that's charged with implementing that authority. And so I know them well. And so we are in very close contact with them, talking about how our authorities can be complementary. There's also the CFIUS, which you've already mentioned. And I will say many members of my staff spent a number of years before coming to my office working on CFIUS issues in a variety of different agencies. And so we have many very good contacts in the CFIUS space, and again, you know, closely are connected with them. And in fact, our executive order and our regulation stipulates that we are not allowed to review transactions that were already reviewed by CFIUS. So that's already carved out of our authority. So there's the FASC, the Federal Acquisition Security Council, which is looking at federal acquisition. And I will just note that our authority actually doesn't distinguish between federal supply chain and commercial supply chain. So our authorities ostensibly apply kind of across the board. But because the FASC exists, right, the idea is that we work very collaboratively with them as well.
You know, and a part of just hearing you talk about the scope, you know, one of the challenges in the export traditional export control framework has been how to address emerging technologies, how to define them, how to regulate them. Is part of the thought here a new tool to target those emerging technologies if there's sort of it doesn't lend itself to a very clear export control?
We certainly could address an emerging technology, but the idea again would be looking at, okay, how is that emerging technology showing up in the United States in the ICTS space? Is it associated with a foreign adversary in some way, and does it cause a risk to national security? Right. So the idea is not just to sort of regulate emerging technologies just for the sake of regulating them, but it's really looking at that foreign adversary connection. Is it showing up in the United States, and is it giving rise to a national security threat?
So you talked about taking action, and we've talked a little bit now about sort of the scope of your authorities and some of the proposed rulemaking, but there are actually actions you can take as well beyond just information collection and sort of regulation. And so could you talk a little bit about what some of those authorities are and what, if any, actions you've already taken to date?
Yeah. So our authorities allow us to kind of have two avenues of implementation. So one is this ability to issue a new rule, which could address a class of technologies, which we've seen in sort of the very beginning steps of in the connected vehicle advance notice of proposed rulemaking, ANPRM. The other thing that we could do is decide, you know, we don't really need to address a class of technology. Really, the threat can be attributed to one or two specific entities. And so we could decide that we are going to take a specific action against those, you know, that one or those two entities. So what happens in that situation is we initiate an investigation, decide that there is a potential risk, and we could choose to subpoena the entity to get more information. Based then on whatever information we have available to us that we've obtained through subpoena or open source information, potentially classified information, we would draft up a risk-based assessment of that entity. That risk-based assessment then gets circulated in the interagency for interagency feedback. If the interagency has comments, they can submit those to us, concerns, we will respond to those. And then based on that feedback, we decide whether to draft what's called an initial determination. And the initial determination is from the secretary and would say to the entity, we believe that your provision of this kind of ICTS in the U.S. poses a national security threat. We are either going to prohibit your ability to provide this ICTS, or we are going to require some sort of mitigating measures to address the risk. That gets sent to the entity. The entity has a period of time to respond. So there's a back and forth. They can propose. They can either say, no, you are misunderstanding the national security threat. There really is no threat here. Let me explain why. Or they could say, we think that these mitigating measures would address the risk that you've identified. And so we can go back and forth with them on what the ultimate result would look like. Based on that information and our own analysis, we then would draft up a final determination. And if we decide to prohibit or to mitigate, that gets circulated again among the interagency for feedback. And then we will publish that final determination in the Federal Register. And the final determination will be very robust to give the public some visibility into what we've considered, how we reached our decision, kind of what factors gave rise to our investigation, why we thought there was a national security risk, why we think what we're doing addresses those risks. We have not publicly announced any of those investigations to date, but we do plan to do so soon. So stay tuned on that one, but there will be a very robust final determination that the public can read.
So you just invited yourself to another podcast, so thank you. happy to have you on again. When you say haven't published yet, are you referring to the final determinations?
Correct.
And so is it possible to give this scale of sort of how many open investigations or initial determinations have been made?
I'm not going to comment on sort of the number of initial determinations, but we certainly have several open investigations right now. And part of that is a product now of the size of my staff. So we have grown significantly over the last year, right? So about a year ago, there were only three or five people, right? We now have a staff of about 50 people. And so we now have the resources to actually really invest in these investigations. So I think, you know, that is why we now are able to actually have a significant number of investigations underway.
I don't want to focus on the numbers for a second. I'm sorry. So I know you also at a recent conference talked about that you're going to be intending to be over 100 by the end of the year. That's, we'll say, ambition. I hope you meet your ambition. That's a massive growth. Mm-hmm. That would make most sort of people, including myself, sort of jealous in terms of like that sort of that exponential growth. Where are all those people going to be deployed in terms of what we just talked about?
Yeah, so we're very fortunate. We got congressional funding, and so we have authority to hire upward of about 115 people. When I say we have about 50 people right now, that's 50 people in my office, but there are about 35 other people that are spread out around mostly the Bureau of Industry and Security who are supporting our office. So think lawyers in the chief counsel's office, people in our budgeting office who are helping with our budgeting, individuals in the chief information officer's office that are now supporting us. So several other kind of supporting staff in addition. So we are about, you know, over 80 people right now. So we really only have about sort of 35 or so more to hire for my office. My office is divided into four divisions. We have our policy division, which drafts all of our rules and regulations and helps to sort of shepherd all of our actions through the interagency process. We have our investigations division, which investigates entities of concern and does those risk-based analyses that I mentioned. We have our compliance division, which, frankly, up to now hasn't been able to do really what its function is, which is to work with industry on complying with our actions. So they've been kind of a jack of all trades, helping out in other areas. But they're now very much engaged in sort of that compliance function as we think through like what would compliance look like in the infrastructure as a service space, what would compliance potentially look like in the connected vehicle space, and they do draft those initial determinations and work with companies then on the back and forth for mitigating measures. So that's our compliance division. And then we have a technology division. And our technology division is, that's the one we are hiring several positions for right now. But those are kind of general computer engineers who help us understand the technologies that we're looking at, who are assessing vulnerabilities, who are looking at mitigation measures, deciding whether they're actually effective. We also have some outside support, in particular for the technology division, because I think while we will have full-time employees, we will need some expertise in certain technologies that maybe our full-time employees might not have. So I think we will always have to kind of reach out to some external support there.
So I'm wondering, with the enforcement actions in particular, what do the tools look like? How do the investigatory authorities work? What do those look like in practice? Because, you know, it seems to me if you're a company receiving a nice letter from your office, you can just choose to ignore it if you don't think there's more to it than that. So what all is at your disposal for those investigations?
So IEPA gives us subpoena authority. And so companies have to respond to a subpoena to the extent they choose not to. I mean, we can't always seek to enforce the subpoena in the courts. So, you know, that is a big hammer, which we are very thankful to have. You know, ultimately, after we issue these actions, if entities choose to violate our actions in some way, we can, there are a couple things. So if we've decided to impose, for example, a mitigating measure, and the company chooses not to effectively implement that mitigating measure, we could instead just move to prohibition. So that would be one potential option. We could impose civil fines, which are also available to us. If it's willful conduct, then under AIPA, there's a potential criminal case. And so then that would get turned over to my old office at DOJ for them to enforce. And you know, within the Bureau of Industry and Security, there is the Office of Export Enforcement, which has federal agents in it. And we do have a few federal agents that are now kind of tasked with helping the ICTS office. And so once we reach that point where we might actually have criminal enforcement cases, they would be assisting with those.
So the focus of what we've been talking about in terms of actions and consequences have been focused, I think, on some of the technologies and the assessments, the determinations, potential mitigation. What about with respect to, for example, infrastructure as a service, some of the proposed requirements that we were talking about, like know your customer, some of the limited reporting requirements? I now use the term limited based on the conversation we just had. So what about in those instances where there's non-compliance? Like, is that also something that would be a focus of your investigation? What are the consequences there?
So I think, you know, there are a number of programs that require companies to have certain safety mechanisms in place, right? So our plan would be to have an audit function that would, you know, sort of randomly, or maybe not randomly, but at some interval, go into these companies, make sure they are actually implementing the program that they've described to us in their customer identification program. And if we find out they're not actually implementing these programs, then again, we have certain enforcement tools available to us, civil fines, criminal, if it rises to that level.
So, you know, talking through those authorities and the enforcement mechanisms you have, the investigatory authorities you have, it seems like things are really relatively developed after a pretty short period of time since these EOs on the ICTS side. But as we were talking about earlier, the IS side is still very much under development, and we're in the middle of a rulemaking process that is not yet finalized, although perhaps the deadline for comments is coming up soon, so may have passed by the time this podcast airs. But I'm wondering, as that process continues and just going forward, what should we be looking for?
Yeah, so in terms of the infrastructure as a service piece, we will very closely review those comments. We very much appreciate any equity holders who are submitting comments. Thank you for those. And, you know, our plan is really to implement something that makes sense and that effectively addresses the risk that's identified in the executive order. So while we are right now at just the proposed rule phase, we do want to make sure that whatever we wind up doing is in line with the goal of that executive order. So we do hope to have something final in the next, you know, many months, but we're not really not sure yet at this point sort of what that will look like.
Just to unfairly ask you about timing, you sort of, you're hoping to make it final in the many months. Is the point there is the expectation or the hope that in 2024 sort of it would be finalized?
We obviously have an election coming up that will impact sort of what new rules we can actually implement. So my hope is that, yes, we will have something finalized in 2024. But again, we want to make sure that whatever we do is appropriate and is effectively addressing that risk.
Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Liz Cannon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both. I enjoyed it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our theme music is from Alibi Music. As always, thank you for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.